Welcome back to those continuing. Welcome anew to those arriving on the third day of Rohatsu Sesshin, celebrating our great beneficent original teacher Shakyamuni Buddha's great awakening. The Buddha's great awakening is none other than the Zazen of the Buddhas and ancestors. Which we have the great fortune and opportunity to practice and practice and practice for these days. And in our countless hours of Zazen, we have the opportunity to explore and clarify the farthest reaches of mind and body of Zazen. And our great ancestor, Eihei Dogen Zenji, left us in his great compassion with these heart teachings about Zazen, the universal recommendation for sitting Zen. The encouragement to everyone to practice Zazen. In Japanese we say Fukan Zazen Gi. So we've been exploring this first teaching that Dogen ever put down on paper and still remains the heart of his Zazen teaching. And we heard that Dogen begins by saying that the way is originally or basically perfect and all-pervading. It doesn't depend on practice or realization.
Page 15, if you'd like to follow along.
And that's the basic pointing out of the reality of Zazen from the very start. And then the rest of the text is elaboration on how to accord with this. And yesterday we heard another, I think, really key section of the Fukan Zazen Gi is learn the backward step that turns the light around, the light of awareness that's directed outward. The backward step turns the light around and shines it back. Our translation here says, turn your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away and your original face will be manifest. So, literally, in Chinese, Ekko Henjo means turning the light and back shining. Or back illumination. Turning the light and illuminating the background. So we hear that awareness, our ever-present ordinary awareness, it's not coming and going, that's actually listening to these words right now, that's feeling the sensation of the body on a seat. That sees the shape of a mid-morning meditation hall. This awareness is always illuminating itself, and it's always illuminating the objects of experience. In other words, the awareness is illuminating the sound of this voice and the color of the room and the sensation of the body. We might even say that the sound of the voice and the colors of the room and the sensations of the body are actually the illumination of the light of awareness. All these experiences that we're having moment to moment are actually the knowing of them. We might say, well, there really is the sound of this voice happening. We can explain how it's vibrations in the air and so on. But that's just a conceptual explanation. Isn't it so that in our actual experience, all there is the knowing of the sound? We might say that colors of the room are a spectrum of electromagnetic radiation of different wavelengths that create red through violet and so on. But again, that's just a conceptual explanation, a good one. This is our world of science. But in our direct experience, is not the colors and shapes, the vision of the room, actually just the knowing of this experience of seeing? We might even say, is not the sound actually just the experience of hearing? There's no sound, in other words, in our experience, we can't really find a sound other than the hearing of it. We can't really find a color other than the seeing of it. We can't find a body other than the sensing of it, the feeling of it. One of the great Chinese Zen ancestors, Lin Ji, said something like, each one of us is this single, lone brightness. That's what we are. I think he's talking about the light of awareness. And this single brightness in the eye is called seeing, in the ear is called hearing, in the nose is called smelling, in the hands is called grabbing, in the feet it's called walking. All of these are just the single brightness of this one awareness. So we turn the light around and shine it back. We're just resting in being aware of being aware. And I think an important point to keep remembering here is that doesn't mean that the colors and the sounds disappear, it doesn't mean that the body and mind disappear. It's just that now we see that the colors and the sounds and the body and the mind are this single one brightness. And as a meditation practice of turning the light around and shining it back, we can say awareness is always aware of itself, and it's aware of the objects, but mostly we're focusing on the objects, because that's what we do as sentient beings, as humans. That's how we negotiate this world, as we engage with the objects of experience. So this is a kind of unusual meditation that we're just slightly shifting the emphasis by turning the light back. We're attending to the light illuminating itself. We're letting that come to the foreground, and we're letting the attention to the objects recedes to the background. There's still sounds, there's still sights, but we're attending, we're putting our attention on awareness itself in the foreground. Very unusual. Without intending to do this, I think this will not happen on its own. Although we might say, in Zazen, resting more and more in the present, letting go of our thinking and engagement with the world of objects of experience, then maybe we start naturally attending more to the self-illuminating light. And for those just arriving, this turning the light around and shining back, we can also hear this instruction come packaged in the words, is awareness present? We can ask such a question at such a time. And ask it sincerely and directly, experientially. Of course, we know the answer already. Yes. Awareness is present. This light of awareness, even when we're really distracted and sleepy or whatever, this light is always present. But as a practice, we have to ask it as if we've never heard such a question, as if we've never asked it before, which is hard to do over and over and over again. But that's, you maybe can come up with your own versions of this, but that's how I've been trying to practice with it. Ask again, is awareness present right now? And in asking the question, in order to answer from our experience, we must turn the light around and shine it back on itself. Yes, it's present. How do I know? It's present. Awareness knows it's present. And that's the beginning. Then from this settling into a new perspective of awareness itself in the foreground and the objects of experience a little bit more in the background, then we can start investigating the objects, looking for what they are from this new perspective of the light, looking at the colors, hearing the sounds. Are they separate from the awareness? And this is where we need to be kind of focused and very curious and diligent and and not jump to any conceptual ideas or anything we've heard, but in our own direct experience, look for where awareness meets the objects of experience, and not find a meeting place because they're not two separate things. Now we're approaching non-duality. So this term that Dogen uses, Ekkō Henshō, turning the light backward, shining. After session, you can ask me for a copy of this if you like. This is a collection I put together of about 20 or 30 different Zen teachers in chronological order in China and Japan who all use the term Ekkō Henshō. So this is not just Dogen. This is like when you see it like this, like 20 or 30 of our ancestors all saying it, you start to wonder, is this really the heart of the teaching that they're proposing? Because here it is. And it would take the rest of the talk to read all of what they say, but since we're on this section of Dogen's version, I'll just point out a few. I think historically, from my research, it seems like the first time this term appears in the Zen records is with Shuto or Sekito Kisen in the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, beautiful poem, where Shuto says, turn the light around and shine back, then just return. And then the next sentence, to kind of clarify this, as the kind of coiner of the term, he says, the vast inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. So turn the light around and shine it back, then just return. We might not even say then. This is just returning. The vast inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. We're talking about the source of mind, the source of everything. The vast, meaning like boundless, inconceivable source, can't be faced as an object, because it's the only thing that's not an object. It's what creates the illusion of all objects. So it can't be faced as something, and it can't be turned away from. You can't get rid of it. You can't ignore it. That's the kind of...
And the source is the non-dual awareness.
Yes, the non-dual awareness. Non-dual awareness means awareness that's not broken up into the illusion of duality of subject and object. Yes, Keegan.
Thanks. Those two statements actually don't seem to go together to me.
How not?
Well, turn the light around, and yet it can't be faced or turned away from. So, on one hand, you're saying this direction, this change, and then on the next, he is saying that it can be faced or turned away from. So, what does it matter?
So, in one sense, we can, if we hear, that's the, one of the problems with this poetic phrase, turning the light around, is it sounds like it's changing the direction of awareness. But in reality, in our actual experience working with this practice, it's not so much that we're changing the direction of outward awareness back to itself. It's more that we're just, one of my teachers puts it like, it's like we have a telephoto or some kind of camera lens that's out here, and it's just like adjusting the lens to make it really wide angle, so wide angle that it's just like all the way around. So it's not so much changing the direction as settling back into space. And then I hear the second line as a kind of just a clarification of this practice. Turn the light around and shine it back, or just settle back into the knowing of experience. And then, this is like a sort of a footnote follow-up, that Shirto says, the vast inconceivable source now is this complete all-encompassing awareness. It's boundless. It's in the ocean with no edges, right? It can't be faced. This is just thinking if we're trying to look for it as some object that we're facing, it can't be faced as another object, and it can't be turned away from, because it's not some location. It's not like inside our head or something, right? It's not, it can't be faced as an object because it includes everything. It can't be turned away from because it includes everything. So in that way, could you see how they go together? Thanks for asking. And then at the end of the same poem, Shirto says, if you want to know the undying person in this grass hut, which is a poetic image for the all-encompassing awareness. If you want to know the undying, unborn person living in this hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. This body, in Zen they sometimes call the skin bag, filled with all this stuff. We might think in many religious traditions, right, that if you want to know the undying person in the hut, that's what you have to do, is separate from the skin bag. But in Zen, it's the opposite. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. Don't separate from this body. Don't separate from these colors. Don't separate from these sounds. Because that's called duality, separation. More like, see that this skin bag is the undying person in the hut. Whereas Dogen says, drop off body and mind as we know them as separate objects. Let body and mind be enveloped by the light. It's another way of saying drop off body and mind. It's not like the butt pain goes away. It's just, then we see the butt pain is nothing more than the knowing of it, the experiencing of it, the awareness of it. Then it's like luminous butt pain. So Dogen himself uses the term ekko hensho a few other times. One time in Dogen's extensive record, he says, everyone without exception holds on to the jewel that glows in the night. Okay. Everyone without exception, even armadillos, aardvarks, and tortoises, holds on to the jewel that glows in the night. Unless we turn the light around and shine it back, ekko hensho, how can we hold close the jewel when we're lost in the outlying countryside? Unless we turn around the light and shine it back and get in touch with this awareness that we are, then how can we hold close this precious jewel that it glows in the night? But we're lost in the outlying countryside, right? We're lost in the world of objects, the darkness and gloom of delusion, right? So we need some shining light here, and the way we carry this jewel when we're lost in the outlying countryside is we turn the light around and shine back. The frontiers. If we're going out onto the frontier lands, the border lands, we need a light that glows in the night. So Dogen says, unless we turn the light around and shine it back, how can we hold close the jewel when we're lost in the outlying countryside? And here's one more from Dogen on Ekko Henjo. Today we're celebrating Ekko Henjo, turning the light and around and shining it back. Dogen says in Gyobutsu Yuigi, the Shobogenzo chapter called The Awesome Presence of Acting Buddhas. Dogen says, thoroughly practicing, thoroughly clarifying is not forced. It's just like recognizing the shadow of deluded thought and then turning the light around and shining it back. So, first of all, this is not something that we can do forcefully, like, come on, turn it back. It's, we're talking about thorough practice and thorough clarification, but not forced. We have to do this in a very relaxed and yet attentive way, maybe like open heart surgery. It's kind of what we're doing here, open heart surgery. First we open up the heart, make expose the heart, and then with this tiny little scalpel start going in there very, very carefully, not in some forced way. And the way to do this is just like recognizing the shadow of deluded thought. And maybe here he's pointing to just dualistic thought is kind of shadowy. It's kind of like obscuring the light. So recognize this shadowy obscuration of deluded thought and turn the light around and shine it back. The clarity of clarity beyond clarity prevails in the activity of Buddhas. This is totally surrendering to practice. To understand the meaning of totally surrendering, you should thoroughly investigate mind. In the steadfastness of thorough investigation, all phenomena are the unadorned clarity of mind. That's it. For me, that's one of the nectar-like sentences of Dogen. In this thorough, careful, open-heart surgery, totally surrendering is thoroughly investigating mind, and in the steadfast of this thorough investigation, we see now that all phenomena always means objects of experience, all phenomena are now realized to be the unadorned clarity of mind. That's, I think, quite a statement. All things, all the phenomena of the world, what are they? They're actually the unadorned clarity of mind itself. Just like Linji says there's this one lone brightness. In the eye, we call it seeing. And we might even say, and even in the eye, we call it the colors that are seen are actually the unadorned clarity of the one brightness. This is the way the Zen ancestors talk when they're thoroughly investigating experience directly. Now, I imagine everyone's in a different place in Sesshin, so we might be just trying to relax, or we might be just trying to stay awake, or we might be just trying to disentangle our snarled, incessant thought pattern that we can't shake. So all of these are also necessary practices, right? If those are what we're working with, we must do these, I think, before open heart surgery. It's not appropriate for the doctor to kind of like running off the street and say, okay, cut this thing open. You know, it's just like open heart surgery. We need to be like really settled. Everybody like in the operating room, let's get really quiet here. Let's not be thinking what we're gonna do with our buddies after the surgery session. That'd be totally it's gonna really mess up open heart surgery. I can't imagine how doctors do this, that kind of thing, that kind of pressure. I mean, in that situation and in this situation, human lives are at stake. Are they not? So we can learn the backward step of turning the light around and shining it back. And for myself, hearing these things over and over and over again has helped me open to such practices. Usually the first time I hear such things, I usually don't like to hear them because I got my own practice I'm working on. And it's not this one. So gently I offer again, and Dogen offers again such practices. Now, now that we've got through the heart of the matter, now we can get into some kind of like practical, ordinary things. This is much easier to grasp these things, but they're good practices. And I would say all of these things now help us to open to this subtle open heart surgery. For practicing Zen, a quiet room is suitable. Practicing Zen here is San Zen. Yeah. San means meeting. So Dokusan means solitary meeting, one-on-one meeting. At the end of this session, we're going to have Shosan, means small meeting. And sometimes we have morning tea called Chosan, means morning meeting. Or Bonsan, means evening meeting. And San Zen is meeting Zen. And at least in modern times, some Soto and Rinzai Zen traditions call Dokusan San Zen. Like Dharma Rain Zen Center, I think, and some others. And Maizumi Roshi, I think they call, instead of Dokusan, they call that one-on-one meeting San Zen, meeting Zen. kind of a nice way to talk about Dokusan, is a way to meet Zen, but also a way to practice Zen while meeting. But elsewhere, Dogen says, San Zen means Zazen. So in Dogen's time, I don't know if it even meant like Dokusan. But for San Zen, or practicing Zen, a quiet room is suitable. Eat and drink moderately. That's what Shakyamuni Buddha learned before his enlightenment, right? First he was into, in the palace, he was maybe eating too much, and then practicing self-mortification, he was into eating too little. So then he took some nourishing rice pudding, and in this moderate eating and drinking, he realized awakening. The middle way. Cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Now it's getting harder. Cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. All affairs is literally like the 10,000 matters. And often it seems like in Sesshin we're thinking of like 10,000 affairs or matters of our ordinary life. So first of all, just cease them. Now this is not so easy, right? But this is our instruction to try again. Dogen says himself, right? Practice is not forced. Like, don't try to cut away all involvements and affairs, but let go of them, I think is what he means. And sometimes it takes a while. That's why Sesshin is nice, because we have a while. We got a while to sit, and if the 10,000 matters are pressing on us, we can let go one at a time. That could take 10,000 moments, where we can all together just rest and enjoy the present. Again, as I said yesterday, I think we're hardwired to always, always attend to what is most pleasant. So if we know that principle, then if we think that our fantasies and engaging in all these plans and activities about some other time and place is most pleasant, then that's what we'll do. So I think there's this trick to like discovering that present awareness is more pleasant than even a really sweet fantasy. And maybe that takes some time too, and getting used to the present awareness. And I think it's more pleasant because it's actually what's happening here and now. It's direct, it's real. Because no matter how sweet the fantasy is, we know that it's not actually real. And that's kind of like taints its joy, actually. Where in a way there's something real about the present moment experience. It's the only reality. Cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons. Cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. So this is abbreviation for literally, Dogen says, cease all the movements of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Or in Sanskrit, cease all the movements of citta, manas, and manovijnana. So the eighth, the seventh, and the sixth consciousness. So basically, without going into all the details about that, every possible dualistic conscious experience is included in this phrase, movements of the conscious mind, all dualistic consciousnesses, even the subtle storehouse consciousness. And the gauging of all thoughts and views is getting entangled in, again in Sanskrit, smriti, samya, and vipassana. You can translate those characters. So, in other words, we could take it as actually this zazen Dogen's talking about is not smriti, or in Pali it's sati, mindfulness. It's not mindfulness. It's not samya is the third skanda, perception or conception. It's not perceiving. And it, vipassana means analytical meditation, insight meditation. It's not that. It's not mindfulness, and it's not vipassana. This zazen that Dogen's talking about, it's something really radical. It's not these. It's actually the ever-present, all-pervading brightness beyond all practices. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. Practicing Zen has nothing whatever to do with sitting or lying down. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha is a quote from this story of Nanyue and Matsu. It's a wonderful story where Matsu is a young monk sitting in Zazen, and his teacher Nanyue comes up and says, what are you doing sitting there? And he says, I'm figuring to make a Buddha, or I'm having designs on becoming a Buddha. It's the same line here, actually. I'm having designs on becoming a Buddha. And then Nanyue picks up a tile, right? A broken roof tile on the ground, and starts polishing it. And Matsu says, what are you doing? And he says, I'm polishing this tile to make a mirror. How can you make a mirror by polishing a rough stone roof tile? How can you make a Buddha by sitting in a certain posture? Right? So this is not something that you gradually do, or that you can do through some activity. So that's the story that Dogen's, one of those Zen story references. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha, or have no figuring to make a Buddha. In other words, don't do this practice like trying to polish a tile to make a mirror. Don't think that if we just line up our body just right, that somehow that will magically produce some kind of Buddha. Buddha's not produced. Buddha's not made. And particularly, I think this next line is referring to the same story. How can you, as Matsu says, how can you make a Buddha by sitting in a certain posture? And so Dogen says, this Zen that he's practicing Zen that he's talking about has nothing to do with sitting posture or lying down posture. It's not a matter of some particular posture. And now the beauty of this is this, because awareness doesn't depend on any posture, right? But right after he says, the Zen that I'm talking about has nothing to do with any particular posture, like sitting. And then he says, at the sight of your regular sitting, spread out a mat and sit like this. I think this is just so sweet how it starts going down one direction, and Dogen says, well, don't think that then you can just, you know, flop out on the floor or something. I mean, you can, but here's a practice that's being offered too, right? At the site of your regular sitting, spread out thick matting and place a cushion on it. In this case, in our modern times we say thick matting is like a zabutan, and then there's a zafu on top of it. And in Dogen's time, they had other terms. Actually, the cushion on top, he calls a futon. Literally, the zafu, he's calling a futon. Futon means a mass of bulrush or grass. That's what futon means. So it's like a stuffed thing. Sit either in the full lotus or half lotus position. In the full lotus position, first place your right foot on your left thigh and your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, simply press your left foot against your right thigh. So, there's many ways to sit. And Dogen's emphasizing this cross-legged sitting. One other essay where Dogen talks about Keka Fuza means full lotus sitting, or literally means like cross-legged. Keka Fuza means like tied cross-legged sitting, and Hanka Fuza means half cross-legged sitting. So that's what's translated here as full lotus and half lotus. There's no lotus in the original. I think that's coming from yoga, Padmasana, right? In modern times we say Padmasana, the lotus position. So those are good postures, but also kneeling, Seiza, is a good posture. And quarter lotus, where you have one foot not on the thigh but tucked into the knees, is also a good posture. Burmese, where you have both feet resting on the mat, is a good cross-legged posture. Sitting in a chair is a good posture, with our feet grounded on the floor and our upper body the same in all of these postures. I usually think of, with all these sitting postures, the upper body is always identical. Ideally, if we don't need to lean back, if we can keep an upright, unsupported spine, that's the best. And then the legs are just to find a comfortable foundation. And from ancient times, of course, this cross-legged sitting is helpful. Is full lotus more helpful than half lotus? Hard to know. Somehow that tradition got passed along. And for some people, right now I'm sitting half lotus, but usually through Sesshin, in Zazen, I sit in the full tied lotus position. I've just gotten used to it. But it did not come actually easily to me. And maybe starting young helped. I remember like 5 minutes in full lotus was like excruciating. But I would do 5 minutes, and that's like an amazing yogic stretch, right? And then I would increase it to 6 minutes, 7, 8, 9, 10, and eventually up to 40. And now, usually for a 7-day sesshin, I'll sit all the zazen periods like that. So the body can be trained, is the point, I think. And my teacher sat that way. I don't know if he still does or not, Tenshin Roshi. And he told a story once that he asked Suzuki Roshi. He said, I notice when I sit in the full lotus, it's not quite as comfortable as when I sit in half lotus, but I can do it. Well, what do you think, Suzuki Roshi? And Suzuki Roshi said, well, then sit full lotus. If you can do it, and even if it's more uncomfortable, I find it's like pretty much the same after a while. And but I think at Tassajara, when asking around, I think most people did not sit in the full lotus position. You can't really tell because they're covered with robes, right? But I think many sitting postures are good to find the kind of stillness and foundation. And you should have your robes and belt loosely bound and arranged in order. Belt here is it's obi, so the priests have this strap around their kimono that's called an obi. That's what Dogen uses here. So if it was still that meaning in the old days, maybe the idea is you can tie that thing really tight and it kind of constricts your breathing. And so don't wrap your kimono obi too tightly, so you can really have this full abdomen breath. Then place your right hand on your left leg and your left palm facing upward on your right palm, thumb tips touching. Thus sit upright in correct bodily posture, neither inclining to the left nor to the right, neither leaning forward nor backward. Be sure your ears are on a plane with your shoulders and your nose in line with your navel. Place your tongue against the front roof of your mouth with teeth and lips both shut. Your eyes should always remain open, and you should breathe gently through your nose. Very practical. Very great instructions. They haven't changed for 800 years. And as far as the feet, you know, you can see in here, if you're sitting cross-legged, Dogen says always have the left foot on top and always have the left hand on top. It's kind of like the Soto Zen party line. And I think in Japan they'll often emphasize always that way. But, doesn't have to be. My teacher recommended if you sit cross-legged to actually alternate each period which leg is on top, which is what I've come to practice. And usually one side's a little easier than the other, so then it's nice to practice the somewhat more challenging side so that you get used to it, and then they become equal. Again, this is training the body and mind. And the story about the left on top, there is such a story that that the left side of the body is like the kind of yin or receptive side, and the right side of the body is like yang or active side. And even Western science talks this way, right? That the maybe left-handed people, left-handed writers, are more kind of intuitive, and the left side of the body is connected with the right side of the brain. The right side of the brain's more intuitive. And it seems interesting to me that they had the same discovery in the ancient days of India, China, and Japan. So the idea is that your receptive side you put on top, the left hand on top, is because Zazen is like the self receiving its function, samadhi. The jiju zamai is like the receptive samadhi. We're just we're not forcing anything. So that putting the left, I mean, this is subtle body stuff in our tradition, that the left side goes on top for that reason. And then when you see Buddha statues, they virtually always have the right hand on top and the right leg on top, opposite of what Dogen says. And the story I've heard is that that's because the Buddhas are no longer practicing this reception of awakening, and they're actively teaching. So they put the right on top, the active side on top. So my teacher taught that if you alternate your legs, whichever leg is on top, put that hand on top. That's what I like to do. Every period I change. Left leg on top, left palm on top, then I switch right. And if you're used to always sitting with your mudra, with one anatta, if you reverse it, it's really weird. It feels like you're just flying off the cushion or something. So again, I think the nice thing about always alternating is we get used to everything. Zazen is like getting used to everything. We don't have one fixed way to always do it. Still, we could say that's not very different, but it's slightly different. And just one last point about the hand mudra here is that Dogen says, if you're sitting in full or half lotus position, it means your foot's on your thigh, then you rest your hand on the heel of the foot, right? And it makes the perfect place, perfect little like shelf for your hand, because then your thumbs are right at your belly button level. This is belly button. So it's which is the ideal place, because this is the hara, the dan tien, that we're encircling with the hand mudra, which I think is an amazing practice. Again, this is also okay for zazen, hands on the knees, but this is like one of the jewels of our tradition, I think, because it's subtle body stuff. It actually has an effect, right, to draw our subtle body energy into the center of gravity, the dan tien, the navel chakra. And this little shelf is nice for that, but if we're not sitting full or half lotus, then I think then the question arises what to do with the hand mudra. If our foot's down here, we don't have that shelf, and then you're suspending it in space, and then I think the shoulders get tired more easily. They're actually, the shoulders are now holding the weight of the hand mudra. There's no weight on the shoulders with resting it on this shelf. So this is something Dogen doesn't bring up, because he only mentions this half and full lotus. So I would recommend like that this is still a good placement for the mudra. So you could even use like a support cushion you can put like on your lap and make a shelf. Or, no, I haven't seen many people do that actually. I saw Maizumi Roshi has a detailed commentary on the Fukan Zazengi also, and he says at this point, he says if you're not sitting in like half lotus or full lotus, you can lower your hand mudra so that your arms rest on your thighs a little bit like that, right? So that you're still, that's gives a support for them. I also heard Suzuki Roshi had a teaching that when he was talking about the details of the posture, he said, this is the place, he said, if your foot is up here, if your heel is up here, you rest your hands there, but not out of convenience, but just because it's the right place. I like that. So it's a little different than the shelf theory that I'm proposing. I think Suzuki Roshi's, you could say there's a subtle teaching in there about don't try to just like find a sort of lazy, comfy place for the hands, but there's this precise place for them. And oh, how nice, there happens to be a shelf there for them too. So, do other people have experience with this hand, people who don't sit half or full lotus have any recommendations? Because I haven't actually experienced it myself. I think people sometimes do hold their hand mudras too high, like at the solar plexus, even from seeing from behind. Sometimes mudras get too high. And to me, this is already, even after 10 seconds, this is feeling agitating to me. And I think it's about chakra stuff, actually. It's like we hold tension, I hold tension around here. So just this 6-inch difference is a huge difference for me. This is really grounding and settling down here. But too low, sometimes it's like the mudra sinks. When I get sleepy, my mudra starts dissolving like water. It goes like this. It starts sinking out. out of the Dan Tien, and the thumb tips start like falling apart. Or since the shelf's on this side, it starts going like, it falls off half the shelf and it goes like this. So, that's the hands and the feet of Zazen. And we'll breathe gently through our nose. Nose in line with the navel means like, I think, vertical this way, and ears in line with the shoulders means vertical this way. Upright. I think upright posture is, again, an amazing gift. Thousands of years old, before the Buddha, people sat in this way. So it's not just random cultural thing, right? All countries, there's the upright posture, the subtle energy, the chi, the prana flows, circulates through the body easily, the breath flows evenly, we stay awake more easily, we can sit for longer periods because it requires almost no muscle power to sit perfectly upright. Whereas if we start leaning a little bit, then it takes a lot of muscles are now working to hold the body upright if we're leaning. But if we balance, especially the head, this is heavy object. If the head can just rest really on top of the shoulders, it's relaxing. Whereas if the head starts going like this, I can feel all these muscles in the back, like now kind of working to hold it. Dedicate the merit of our sitting upright to all beings everywhere. May our uprightness radiate throughout the universe to benefit everyone. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.